Okay, today about sound source localization. Yesterday I talked about spatial representations and biological data, so to speak, the one-hand stream of our work. Today it should be something pretty much completely different. Spatial processing and really applied signal processing based. So there is not really much. Some physiological or psychoacoustic motivation in it, but it's small. So today we are really on the applied side. I'm still missing my espresso shot from today because somehow the local caffeine outlet neglected my order and it just didn't arrive. So I somehow managed to leave without the espresso.
Isn't there espresso here?
So no, don't worry. So if I'm a bit slow, maybe that's the reason I have.
It's the espresso with a syringe.
All right. So spatial sound processing, we all know about it. For example, let's say we have a speaker, a target source somewhere located in space. Thresholds are nice, we can detect it. If there is an interfering sound source from the same location, thresholds are much higher, detection is much poorer, and this spatial masking is released once we move our interfering source to a different location. And this, of course, relies on all the factors that, or part, and probably the most largest part of that effect is due to the fact that we have two ears. We do multi-microphone processing, if you already call two ears multi. And we can evaluate both the level and the timing differences from the different source locations, be it the target source or the interfering source or an entire ambient sound field. So the point we have been working on and that I want to make here is that in order to localize sounds, it's a reasonable assumption that we are drawing on a couple of effects. Part of our processing will be just hardwired, genetically programmed, whatever. Mechanisms that are just there and we take them for granted, and they probably evolved over a long time, but we wouldn't be expecting to change them on the fly, for example. But we will also have long-time learning by exposition to a large number of spatial acoustic scenes where sources have occurred with all spectro-temporal characteristics from all spatial locations, so that we can really build a mental image of what on average we expect or what on average arrives from the surrounding space. However, as we also all know, due to simple physics, this will not always be the same, but it will change extremely quickly. I just need to move my head and all the transfer functions in this room are altered to a large extent. So we also will need to have mechanisms that allow us to adapt on the fly on a time course of, psychoacoustics is probably saying something like a couple of hundred milliseconds if we reorient in space. But the point is that when we move to a new environment, we will of course want to keep what we have already learned about, for example, head geometry, average sound fields, etc., pp. So I would like to go through a simple hierarchical architecture, a succession of processing stages from sensors to, well, to what I would call a mid-level spatial map representation, and then in the sense of a technical application back to the sensor level in order to perform signal enhancement. So in a way, we are traversing levels from sensors to somewhat internal or mid-scale representations and back to sensors, because in applications we are not just happy with detecting objects, recognizing objects, but we have in a sense a much harder task that we even have to reconstruct them in the time domain, just not as mental percept, in the time domain with a better signal to noise ratio, better speech intelligibility whatsoever. So that's the last part here is actually highly non-trivial, even if we have arrived at a faithful representation somewhere in the middle. So these are then subdivided to what I've already mentioned into hard-coded features, something that we learn over a training data set over extended period of time, so to speak, and some parameters for the spatial processing that we will need or that we will readapt quickly on short utterances. So let's first look very briefly at the sensor setup. The microphone geometry, we are using our beloved Brüel-Kjær heat and torso simulator, which is outfitted with hearing aid dummies, which are now already a little bit aged, but they still do their job. And they have six microphones, which sometimes we use all of them, but on usually four channel processing, two on the left, two on the right hand side is fine. So we have in principle three channels on each side available. And from these we've also a while ago recorded on relatively large, good quality database of heat-related transfer functions, or both in anechoic environments and also in echoic environment, and that's more room-related impulse responses for this heat geometry. And these are available if you want to download them, and they are picked up for 5-degree azimuth angles, number of elevations, and two distances. As I said, both in the anechoic environment, and we also have one set for an office environment where you can get transfer functions. And in particular for evaluation, it's quite useful that we have made several recordings with backgrounds and target sources in some real environments where you don't need to mix your background and target signals. So these are really realistic. We use these transfer functions to basically simulate all our data, if you will. But we are very faithful that these simulations are really pretty realistic. So that brings us to the next step, hard-coded features. This will actually be just one brief point. For this application, we're just looking at the standard features that engineers usually use. Generalized cross-correlation phase transform features, which you can think of as a cross-correlation function between the different microphones. So they pick up time delays, both between both sides of the head, and also between the microphone, the smaller microphone distances on each side of the head. So we evaluate these for all possible combinations. What is the generalized and the phase transform? In addition to the cross-correlation function, it basically weighs all spectral components equally. That's it. Phase transform means we retain only the phase, so this is actually the frequency domain formulation of the cross-correlation, and we just divide the magnitude out so that essentially you could think of this as a pre-emphasis filter in a way, in order to not neglect the high frequencies that are crucial for localization. So this is really standard, but there's not much psychoacoustics behind it. Our long-time exposure to an environment, learning. So here we are using a bank of support.
So you only take phase differences into account, not level differences?
Correct. It works too. It's again one of the things where one would say it's so simple, it works really well. It works much better than just taking the cross-correlation function, because the cross-correlation function is influenced by the power spectrum. So you would, in the standard cross-correlation, you have a strong in effect of the low frequencies, whereas the high frequencies are a little bit not neglected, but so this is really the extreme case. Basically, you assume a wide spectral power density and only take the phases then.
So I guess it's for the temporal differences, but I guess your question is, wouldn't the level differences also just be useful for?
The level differences would be implicit if we were taking the normal cross-correlation function, so to speak. Of course.
It may not actually last in the cross-correlation, but just as for sort of information about location.
Sure. The levels, level differences do carry information, particularly in each side, they would not carry a lot of information, but across left and right cluster of microphones, yes, of course.
Is it typically in more complex environments, so the envelope fluctuations are reflected as IOPs?
Yes. Yeah. So we've published, I don't know, 2 years ago, also a paper where we made a statistical model for interaural phase differences, frequency dependent, and interaural level differences, both of them, which was more, in a way, it's more like psychoacoustics. It's more if you want to make a psychoacoustically plausible model. And I agree with you that we might be losing information here. We may be able to get better even for technical systems if we were also taking into account level differences, for example, there are also still other things.
Okay, so I think one answer is that because you have six microphones on the hearing aid, already from one hearing aid, you actually try one. So I guess you still have two, but the idea is these six microphones from one hearing aid might actually give you a good spatial localization, and because they are so close together, then level differences basically are non-existent, and it's all phase differences. It's even at high frequencies, phase differences make sense because they're so close together. Is that kind of the rationale?
For the microphones that are located on either side, but for the left-right differences, I fully agree. We could soak more information out of the data, so to speak. We could become more psychoacoustically, physiologically plausible from a fundamental point of view. From an engineering standpoint of view, we could just exploit the data more. I'm sure.
And regarding, so you have so many microphones now that are very close to each other, right? So is this effective? Because normally, of course, you would profit a lot from more space, but you don't have that, so they're very closely located.
Yeah.
Is it effective for the task?
Yeah. What we see is what I think everybody is seeing. This you can be really good at frontal hemisphere localization if you just have two microphones. Of course, then you will have front-back confusions. You can really be good at 360-degree localization if you have four microphones, two on each side. We get almost no benefit from the additional two ones. So six-channel. 3 plus 3 gives us almost no benefit compared to 2 and 2. And I think everybody knows this, and that's why hearing aids only have 4 and not 6.
Are you question, what skill are you taking the transforms? This transform is taking over, it's been taken
10 milliseconds.
10 milliseconds.
So for localization, we are looking at faster time scales than we would usually need for speech processing, which would be more on the order of 30, 10 milliseconds, and a 1 millisecond frame shift. And the interaural time differences are evaluated. We take the Fourier transform over 10 milliseconds, but the interaural time differences are evaluated only up to, cut them at 1 or 1.5. milliseconds, because 1 millisecond is about the largest time difference you would get. So these are then small snippets of cross-correlation functions, and they differ by sound source direction, they differ by the microphone pairs you look at, but we evaluate them as for all possible microphone pairs. And then we just use these as features, as an input to a bank of support vector machines, still a little bit old-fashioned, but they work so nice. And they are even linear, so we use a linear projection, which looks at each cross-correlation function. And we use a linear projection, linear SVM, for each direction. So in a way, you could say we train a couple of model neurons in hypothetically somewhere in our brain, where each of them is trained to say, here, it's me, whenever a source from its target location is active. And we do that for all source positions in possible source positions in five degree intervals. In order to get proper a posteriori probabilities, we fit a nonlinear function, actually a generalized linear model, but a very simple one, one-dimensional, that transforms these support vector machine outputs, which are kind of on a linear scale, into a proper probability. And we skip the well, we basically skip the equations, but you can, of course, decide for the best location, best direction, where you have the highest probability estimate, but you can also work on this entire probability image, so to speak. And that looks like this. Say we have a target source from a little bit, maybe 30 degrees to the right or something like that. Here we plot the azimuth value. Zero would be the frontal direction. So this source here might actually correspond to this direction here. And across time, so here we have 700 milliseconds, we see that the estimated probability for each time point and each direction varies quite quickly across time. If we look into this target direction, for example, we see a clear peak near this 30 degree of that source. And we also see that at the same time, there appears to be a different localized source at minus 60 or so, somewhere here. And we can simultaneously resolve the temporal activity of that other source as well. So that gives us a pretty clear picture at which time instances with a few milliseconds resolution and at which spatial location do we have activity. Well, actually, it's a little bit triggered towards speech activity because that's what you trained the classifiers, the estimators on, but it will be relatively sensitive to all sources. And we have this running in real time on the head and torso simulator, and it really works pretty nicely and gives you a relatively good and fast resolved image of what's happening. Yes?
How much training data do you usually need to get a good model?
I think that's the next slide. So that is actually something that is not trivial, or it's simple, but we have made the best experience by using noisy training data. So we first of all, we train only in an anechoic environment, so we use no reverberation during training. Second, during training, we use only a single source. We also tried on combinations of sources, but here we look at only a single source located anywhere 360 degrees. Crucial seems to be that it's very helpful for this classifier training, for the detection training, to embed this localized source in an isotropic noise field. So we simulate a noise field with speech simulating noise coming from all 360 degree directions, so that our target source is always embedded into a diffuse spatial noise field, isotropic. And that seems to really help localization performance of the system when you test it. Our test data is using both anechoic and reverberant environment, but we do not retrain. Our experience is, if we train the system properly, the anechoically trained system really is capable of robustly localizing also in reverberant environments. So office, courtyard, cafeteria with different reverberation times.
So did you say if you train in anechoic, then it works also in reverberant, or was it the other way around? Didn't you say that if you train in more noisy backgrounds, then it works.
We train noisy but anechoic.
Oh, noisy but anechoic.
So the source always has basically only time delays, HRTFs from the anechoic chamber. But there is isotropic noise, but also during
training.
It's also dry noise. It's coming from all directions, but all also convolved with anechoic HRTFs. And our just empirical experience is that when we want to use the system in reverberant environments like this one here, whatever, or we do not need any retraining for a robust localization. Yeah.
The sources always assume to be like infinitely far away, or? So you take care about orientation, or if you train this with different distances, you...
We are in the anechoic chamber, we have the data for two distances, 80 centimeters and 1.50 meters, I think. But 1.50 meters apart in the non-reverberant environment, it's basically already far field. Mm-hmm. It's really just direction dependent, and there is not much of distance dependence on in the data anymore.
Clarification. The tumor head is fixed, right? Like nothing else is moving.
Yes. So we had this picture somewhere here.
Yeah. So it's just sitting.
It's sitting here, and the sound source was moving around it.
Sound source.
Yeah.
The head is fixed. When you're doing measuring the transfer.
Obviously there are two ways. You fix the head and rotate the sound source, or you fix the sound source and rotate the head in five.
But what we need is one plot where the source was at 30 degrees has moved, and then there was in this plot you had at that direction activity, but also at -50 degrees. Where did this come from?
Or did you mean the target direction? The target direction is really anywhere. So referring to the physical measurement process, I'm not exactly sure whether we moved the sound source or whether we, just for measuring the HRTFs, or whether we rotated the head itself. But for the sake of localization during both during training and during testing, we always have sources from all directions.
But why does target? It shows only two source directions.
Okay, so during training time we have one source.
Sorry. I think that what is confusing is that this thing has peaks at -40, but the drawing on the right has a face at +20.
Yes, yeah, about 30.
They are not the same, right?
Okay, this or, yeah, okay.
The drawing does not correspond to the spatial map you're showing.
This is just an artist's depiction, so to speak, of the supposed target source direction. But this is, of course, not clear. I mean, which one would be target source and which one would be interferer is our definition in a way. I just wanted to make clear that one would be supposed our target direction, maybe this one here, and that during testing time, the classifier has the ability to also simultaneously identify localized energy, so to speak, from different directions. But during training, it was always one source from there. In so to speak, different training epochs or training examples, it was one source occurring from different directions.
And did you say that you're trying to just localize, or you're also trying to segregate and enhance the source?
First, we need to localize, and then we need to segregate. But for source separation, we really need to take into account more the actual physical surroundings. So for source separation, it would not be enough to work anechoically, but you would really need to do more work. And that's actually the part where I'm heading. Yeah.
If you do the localization based on the time delay, then you need to know the geometry between the microphones, right? So you would need to know, if you use all the four channels, you would need to know the distance between the ears of the person. So my question is, if you train your model for one configuration, would it still work if another person with a wider head or a smaller head would use that?
We did it anecdotally, training the system on the Brüllenkjær head. and placing it even on subject ears, which would have a slightly different distance, interaural distance. It works roughly, but it will need to break down, right? This is just physics. So if you really change the distance between ears, so the head size geometry, then it has to break down at some point. We didn't test it out systematically when that happened.
When you have trained your model, I guess you should be able to recover actually this geometry of microphones that we just spoke about, right? Because basically you know the physical model, like where these microphones are, mm-hmm. and how they would allow to detect location based on phase differences. So are you able to do that? Are you able to recover the geometry from the kind of what these models have learned to have?
We didn't try it, but it would be encoded there. In principle, it should be able to. We should be able to somehow squeeze that out of the learned classifiers. I mean, they have an implicit representation, which both it needs to take into account three things: the interaural time difference for a specific location. But since it's been trained on a full ensemble of sources coming from everywhere, it sees more. It sees speech-like characteristics because the target source is always speech during training. And third, it needs to do some kind of discrimination because it's also classifier looking into, say, 30-degree direction is instructed to say, yes, it's me when it's 30 degree. But when there is a source at 35 degrees, he is trained to say, no, it's not me. So this discriminative element of our training will also alter this implicit encoding of the spatial model. So there are a couple of factors that go into the finely trained system that are implicitly in going into that one.
If you put multiple sources, do you see multiple peaks? Because what I'm surprised here is that you have the volume noise, you have the speech, and at any given time, there seems to be like one, there's a little bit of a snippet between 25 and between 0.25 and 0.4 where you actually have two simultaneous peaks, okay? But most of the times when you have one peak one place, it completely inhibits even having a small local peak on the other one.
Mm-hmm.
If any. And I didn't see that in the cross correlations you built any implicit winner they call anything, okay? So what?
Yeah. I would say there is something like, probably there is something like an effective masking going on, that the stronger source and its temporal differences somewhat mask, though not in the psychoacoustic sense, but here effectively in a signal processing, mask the activity of the surroundings of the other localizers.
But that means that when you divide by the absolute values of the Fourier transforms, you're taking the transform only over the frequency bands of speech. Because if you were taking that Fourier transform over an entire frequency band, okay,
we cut 8 kilohertz or something like that.
Okay.
I would need to look it up.
So in that case, you have effectively implemented masking of the noise by the speech.
Yes. But these two sources would live in the same. These would both be speech sources, and the isotropic noise that we use during training is speech simulating. So it has the same spectrum, and at least the same spectrum. I'm not sure about modulations.
Yeah. In the test conditions, you had multiple sources, but are you saying that there's sort of some kind of sparseness constraint built into your classifier that's sort of forcing it to only have one source? Or if you have two simultaneous sources, can it show two peaks?
It can to some extent. It depends on the spatial separation of them, how close they are. But we do see simultaneous peaks. There is no explicit constraint for only one source peak at a time. It's really just by this discriminative training nature that I referred to.
Okay.
And you have normalization of it. I mean, if you have two sources, the peaks cannot remain as high, right?
That's an additional point. We, at the moment, we do basically a softmax. We for each time point, we normalize the entire probability mass to one, which is of course wrong if you have more than one source. Which kind of, it's not the fault of the system or of the classifier thrust or post-processing, so to speak, that would in the dual source case. Diminish their contributions, both of them. We tried training on source combinations because we thought we should get a more fine-grained picture. That's quite obvious, right? It gives us a very small advantage if the sources are spatially nearby, but the advantage that we get is much smaller than I would have expected or guessed in the beginning. So it's really tiny what we get.
Yeah.
So in a way, we are really looking at a simple system, maybe oversimplified. There are many things you could do better, but it's still working.
But I mean,
reasonably
on
well.
The other hand, you could also think of like be having like a binary classifier for like frequency intervals. So in that case, you could take a sigmoid for each frequency, for each angle's output. This would much more allow you to have like more.
That's what we do. Okay. So we have one independently trained and independent binary classifier for each direction. That's what you were suggesting, or did I miss?
Yeah, because you said you're using softmax over.
And
over
so to speak here, and then this is all still direction independent. So this is so to speak one per direction, independent for each direction, and here at the end, it's not drawn here. We do a softmax normalization.
Mm-hmm.
So that's this problem of this scaling. Why do we do it? Well, we do it because in noise, these probabilities per se are reduced already. So we are not really the physical environment or the physical factors when we move into new environments make all this learning of a posteriori probability a bit faint. Because those get diminished if you have reverberation, for example. So we do the rescaling in order to get kind of better or more stable spatial images, but it also has negative effects. I mean, it's often the case that really the probability estimates, likelihood estimates of artificial systems can only be judged in relation to comparison. So absolute probabilities are really difficult to get on new generalization data.
If you look at the support vectors, do you see anything interesting? Or is this?
Yes. Good question. Small sidetrack. we can look at the weights of these. It's just scalar vectors of 1.5 milliseconds length, and they reflect the corresponding interaural time or intermicrophone time of arrival difference, but they are more than just small snippets of these cross correlation functions for the corresponding time shift. I think because of these two things which you already mentioned, they are trained on speech in noise, and they have this discriminative property that they need to discriminate themselves from the next spatial location bin, so to speak. So they are plausible, but they are not they are more than just the cross correlation functions. So we are already at 10:41. We started a bit later. So maybe one performance picture, and then we get to the one performance picture for reverberant test data recall and precision over a number of signal to noise ratios. Our algorithm is this one. It's pretty good. I wouldn't say it's really the best one that's out there. We compared to a couple of standard algorithms. Some of them are in a similar ballpark, others are not so good. One thing that surprised us is that a so-called subspace method music, which is really a standard localization or estimation method, really seems to be confused by these relatively realistic test settings that we have. So we have one target source, target direction embedded in isotropic noise, and at least one additional interfering source, and up to three interfering sources. And that really seems to confuse some standard algorithms. Actually, I talked to Dick Lyon last week when he was still here, and he seemed to make the impression that the practitioners also know that, that if you want to go to reverberant environments, get robust localization, some of the algorithms that are in textbooks, for example, don't seem to work that well or break down in a non-benevolent way, if you wish. But I'm sure there are also other good algorithms out there which we haven't tested, but this one's at least decent, I would say.
So what's the task that you're having it perform?
Localize a target source at different signal-to-noise ratios in a mix of isotropic noise and interfering localized target source.
So how does it know what the target source is?
We know where the target source is. So what went into the evaluation here is whether it produced a significant peak at the target source direction. So it was, of course, still allowed to produce peaks at the other directions of the other sources and anywhere else. We didn't care. The question was whether it detected in the target source direction. Yeah, so it's possible to make that comparison.
How does this compare to human performance, especially like at SNRs of like minus 10 or negative ones? Like, how do human listeners do it?
Ask the psychoacousticians. I don't know. I don't have it on top of my.
So these measurement of performance is some measurement of how many times did it agree with the. I'm trying to put this into units.
Okay. Similar question.
Does this mean that it's 5 degrees localization accuracy when you move one over the range? I'm trying to understand what it means.
Here it means, did the system detect a target source at the specific location with a 5 degree accuracy? Maybe we also count it as correct a plus minus 5 degree error. I would need to check but it's a correct, not correct. So a percentage correct decision that we make, which is a bit different from what people usually do in psychoacoustic studies, where they have average angular error, or sometimes they also subdivide that into gross error and fine error. So whether you are in the same ballpark or somewhere completely off, and fine error would be if you're near the source, how much your small deviation would be. That are, I think, standard measures that are more in the physiologically psychological.
I agree that, what do you say about the right panel there? It's all close to one, so how do you evaluate? Is it now almost simply perfect, or what's the result?
Well, it's going down to 50% and even
on the right. This precision thing. So what does it now tell us?
It's in terms of errors you make, we are talking about at least a doubling of the errors, right?
So there was an interferer from another direction. Did I get that right? So if it puts a peak at the interferer, is that an error in terms of the precision during annihilating? So with an algorithm which detects two peaks, would that be penalized for that?
No. So that's, I think, similar as David's question. We only evaluate whether it detected at the target source direction.
So
we didn't care what it did for the other directions.
What's the precision measure? How is precision defined?
It's the standard. So recall is how many of the targets did it detect correctly, and precision is how many of the target detections were correct target detections and how many were incorrectly detected targets.
So this is why I'm asking for the interferer, if it was an incorrect target detection, if it detected the interferer.
No. Because the interferer would have been at a different position. And for our evaluation, we were only looking at the true source position, whether the true source was detected or not. It could detect anything else it wanted anywhere and in all the other directions. Actually, it would need to, because we had 2, 3, or 4 sources. So some of these situations were really difficult. But that's, so we tried to get pretty realistic and see where things break down.
So I don't know if it's true, but basically, I guess, were the interferers being accidentally classified as targets? Is that your question? So if you have an interferer, did that increase the likelihood of an error?
No, because we know the ground truth source direction. So maybe if we go to back to the previous image here. So let's say this is the ground truth source direction for this specific training testing example. Then we would only evaluate all the different localization systems whether they detected or did not detect a source in this direction. Of course, because there was also another source, an interferer at minus 60, a good method should also have detected minus 60. But we didn't care. We didn't penalize that. We didn't count it as positive or negative whether they did not detect anything here. That's as fair as we think we could get in that multi-source setting. Yeah. So I will need to stop at some point, but let me please just come the main point, which I think is interesting, and I think other people are also finding interesting. So now we have arrived from our sensor signals at this probabilistic map, internal representation of space, if you will. Now, as in our engineering side, we need to go back to audio signals and produce well-sounding audio signals that a customer, whoever, can listen to. So we need to go basically back to the microphone domain, to time waveforms. How do we go back from this high or mid-level representation back there? And second is, in order to do that for this spatial signal enhancement, there we really need to take care in which room we are in now. We cannot just use our trained system from the anechoic chamber, put it into our nice seminar room, and steer beamformers or do some spatial filtering. Because this last part is hard, because it really requires very precise knowledge of the actual room transfer functions where you are in now, where you are recording the signals in at this millisecond. And when you move a little bit, you need to know now new transfer functions. All this is still working in novel environments up to here. But that part really needs to be adapted in hundreds of milliseconds. So I will try to go through this quickly and just give you the main point. Our basic idea is we exploit this probability map that we have. We detect the highest peak with some temporal averaging, and in a way just determine what is the source direction into which we want to listen. So what is the direction where this target source is coming from? And that we can get from our spatial image. How do we get to these physical room parameters in this possibly new environment? Well, what we do is we estimate a spatial covariance matrix of which encodes the spatial characteristics of our present environment in terms of where what arrives at different microphones. And in order to do this averaging, we exploit our knowledge of the speech source or the target source probability. And what we estimated previously with our support vector machines and our spatial activity map, this probability goes as an averaging weight into our estimation of this coherence, spatial coherence. What this gives us is that we obtain the spatial coherence in our new environment for some sound that is specifically arriving from the direction which we selected, namely our source direction. So this is basically, if you will, the transfer function, an approximation of the transfer functions from our source to our microphones in the new environment, building upon our previously trained anechoic model. I'll skip over the more technical steps, so to speak, and just try to give you the ideas. Now we know acoustic parameters for the source. To reduce the interference, the noise, we need to know also the acoustic parameters of everything else, of the interfering sound field. And that could be another localized source. It could be ambient noise coming from anywhere, whatever. We just don't know. So what do we do? Well, basically, we want to have the acoustic parameters of all the other directions. And the very simple idea that we make is, well, we have the probability for that direction. Why not just cut a hole into that direction and weight everything else except those components that come from that direction? So we take 1 minus the probability of the source of this target source speech activity and say 1 minus the speech probability is just the probability that at a particular, say, 1 millisecond time instance, sound has been coming from any of the other directions. And then we compute again a spatial. So here we have this 1 minus the speech probability as a weighting factor in order to compute the spatial coherence covariance matrix for all the other directions. So that's a very crude approximation to computing the spatial characteristics of everything else except for the source that you're interested in. And yeah, mathematically it can be done. It works sometimes. We have some evaluation data which I will briefly show. And then we plug these covariance matrices just into a standard. Here we used an MVDR beamformer minimum variance distortionless response beamformer. That's just a standard signal enhancement technique, which, however, needs as input these spatial covariance matrices that I already mentioned for source direction. Separately for source direction, that's this D, and for the interfering sound field, that's the R. I will briefly skip through evaluation and I think we already discussed this. This was our testing setup for the subsequent numerical evaluation. Isotropic noise field, 1 target source from 1 direction, and an interfering source, localized source from a different direction. Maybe skip through this. We did some I'll try to skip this a little bit. We did some comparisons when our probabilistic estimation method of the room parameters was best. That's always when we have probabilistic model here. In some cases, it might be best to just use a free field model, like a source may arrive just with interaural time differences, like in the anechoic chamber, but no reverberation. So we might not always re-estimate the room parameters, but just compare to what would happen if we plugged in a standard fixed free field model for an identified source direction. And that gives rise to a couple of situations which we compared. In the interest of time, I think I should largely skip over this and tell you that in the anechoic environment, what turns out is best is if we use our probabilistic model, the source localization, but use a free field model for the target source direction and our full technique for the interfering source directions. It's slightly better than re-estimating everything in the anechoic chamber, which of course is because in the anechoic chamber the head-related transfer functions are best. There is no need to re-estimate them, so to speak. If we move to reverberant test conditions, it turns out that in most of the cases, we really need our fully probabilistic model. First, localize the source, then re-estimate the source parameters in a new environment, and re-estimate the interference parameters in a new environment, and then perform signal enhancement. In most situations, that gives the best results. There are some exceptions. You can ask me later. I'll skip over that here. And finally, briefly mentioned, we also used it in together with speech recognition in this nice CHIME 3 speech recognition task, where they had a completely different microphone geometry. People were having tablets with six microphones and were reading text from Wall Street Journal, etc. So we adapted our technique to that geometry, coupled it with speech recognition. The speech recognition actually used modulation features that we talked about at length yesterday as features, and then some deep neural network kind of stuff. And in the test data set of that benchmark data, we performed significantly better than the baseline, even though our system, I haven't mentioned that, in this case, needed much less prior information than the baseline systems here. So we were quite happy with that. Last slide. Where are we heading at? This is where we are at the moment. We have our probabilistic map, and then we go back into physical space for signal enhancement. What we are currently working on is introducing one more component, an object grouping component, which aims to group different spatial components that belong to a single physical source. For example, something like direct sound propagation and reflection information from a hard surface or something like that. So sometimes we see these mirror images of reflections, and these and similar components should be grouped into a source as well, and then perform the reconstruction. Okay, so I hope I've convinced you a bit that supervised learning for localization of sources is good, and that it permits a rapid re-estimation of acoustic parameters in order to perform source enhancement in real and varying acoustic environments. So, thank you.